And we're taking a chronological look. If you want, you can take your Bibles and turn to Exodus chapter 1. By the way, thanks to the folks who brought the breakfast goodies. Jared's going to hit cleanup, I think, and just pile it onto a platter.
Take the whole thing.
Now, I think that's the Greenlaws and Angela. I don't know if anybody else contributed, but thank you to that. We're going to continue on today in our chronological look at the Scripture. Today is one general time frame that essentially covers the lifetime of Moses. Okay, so we're just viewing this as one big time frame. It will essentially cover the books of Exodus through Deuteronomy. So again, this is chronologically, this is how things were written, time period, biblical time period, and so forth. There's a lot here that we could cover, and of course you realize this is an overview of these things. It's not meant to be super in detail, but we'll take a look at some of the major events in this timeline. You have an outline if you want to use that to just highlight some of the big points and a few subpoints there if you wish to follow that. We'll jump right in today. The first big thing that we'll talk about today is the Egyptian bondage, the time of Egyptian bondage. So the end of Genesis ends, it almost seems like, and they lived happily ever after kind of a story. You know, the Israelites are in Egypt and they're growing and they're thriving. They're in the land of Goshen. They're multiplying and things seem great. Joseph dies, but you know, they're still there and God's protected them and all this kind of stuff. But then you come to the beginning of the book of Exodus and we get a little bit different flavor. In Exodus chapter 1, verse 8, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. A little bit of a clue that, something might happen here that may not be as good for the people of Israel. The people of Israel had grown a lot. Verse 7 says, they increased abundantly, multiplied, grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Okay, now, these first few verses of the opening of Exodus, it requires a lot of time. So I say what we're going to cover today is generally the lifetime of Moses, but understand there's a time frame a little bit before that. Anybody need a hand up? Please raise your hand. Daniel's got some. Thank you, Daniel, for doing that. They went to Egypt with 70 people. They come out of Egypt with, as some estimate, up to 2 million people. Of course, that takes time. To grow that many people in a nation, okay? But they grow a lot, they fill the land, and now they're viewed as a threat to the Egyptian leadership, and the Egyptian leadership begins to oppress them. Thank you. And the oppression is great. Now, it was during that time that Moses is born. So chapter 2, we have a recording of Moses being born. We know the story. Time of great oppression of the Israelites. Pharaoh had ordered the male children to be killed. But Moses is born. His mom and dad hide him, put him in the bulrushes and try to make him safe. And he floats down the river. Providentially, God allows Pharaoh's daughter to see him in the water and to take him in and essentially call him her own. Hebrews calls Moses the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Okay, so that's a very fast, quick overview of this, but it gets us into the life of Moses. So let's talk about him a little bit. A key person, of course, in Old Testament as well as New Testament biblical history. The life of Moses is easily distinguished into three sections of 40 years each. When he was 3 months old, he was placed in the water, found by Pharaoh's daughter. Pharaoh's daughter found his biological mother, and again, providentially, and she weaned him. Probably took a couple, 2-3 years for that. And then he was officially, essentially adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, and raised in the Egyptian setting. Educated, the ways, culture, all this kind of thing. A cross-reference, I don't think I put this on your outline, but if you want to write it down, you can, to help us understand these 40-year increments. In Acts 7, verse 23, it tells us of Moses, "Now when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel." So he'd been raised in Pharaoh's court, essentially, the son of Pharaoh's daughter. For 40 years, he grows up in that. Some even have speculated that Moses may have been in the line to become the next Pharaoh, or at least in that line of Pharaohhood, because he was the son of Pharaoh's daughter. But nonetheless, he spends 40 years, and now he wants to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. Now, he is essentially viewed as an Egyptian, but he knows his Israelite, his Hebrew roots, and he goes to visit them. So that's Acts 7, verse 23. That corresponds with Exodus chapter 2, verse 11 and following. And the story is he ends up defending an Israelite, he kills an Egyptian, and he leaves Egypt for his life, and he went to Midian. Acts 7, verse 30 says, "And when 40 years had passed, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in a bush in the wilderness of Mount Sinai." That's Exodus chapter 3. Okay, so we have these 40-year increments. The first 40 years were in Egypt, right? Raised in the court of Pharaoh, educated and so forth. When he was 40 years old, he visited his own people, but he got in the scuffle, killed an Egyptian. I believe it was the very next day. He says, "I need to leave this place," and he leaves and goes to Midian. That's where he spends the next 40 years in Midian. Becomes a shepherd, gets married, has children. And that's his second time period of his life. He's in Midian. That's essentially chapter 2. Chapter 2 of Exodus covers about 40-ish years. But then he sees the Lord in the burning bush. And he's called to go back to Egypt. Call the people out, or call Pharaoh to release the people. And the next 40 years he spends in the wilderness. So we have these very easy to understand 40-year periods of Moses' life. 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in Midian, 40 years in the wilderness. And we know he was 120 years old because Deuteronomy 34:7 tells us that he was 120 years old when he died. Of course, after the burning bush, Moses left to go back to Egypt to lead God's people out. And another incredible thing took place. When he's talking to Pharaoh, he finally says, "You need to let the people go or else." And we have these 10 plagues of Egypt. This is a major part of the story of the Exodus in general. I want to quickly go through these 10 plagues, because these were not just really bad things that happened. These were God displaying himself to be superior to Egypt and their gods. So we have plague number one, turn the Nile into blood. That was a confrontation of this god named Hapi. I'm probably way mispronouncing these, but you'll forgive that. Hapi represented both the fertilization of the land as well as nourishing of the land. The Nile was an incredibly important part of that in Egyptian life. And so God turned the water into blood. Plague number two, plague of the frogs, which was God's declaration of superiority over the Egyptian god Heket, a god with the head of a frog. Plague number three, gnats or lice, was the confrontation of the Egyptian god Geb, the god over the dust of the earth. And here the dust of the land becomes lice or gnats, some kind of two-winged biting insect. It was a great nuisance. It is God saying, "I am stronger, I'm better, I'm superior to you." Plague number four is the flies. This plague, God declared himself greater than the god Khafre, who had the head of a fly. These swarms of flies came into the land, but God separated his people from the plague. Plague number five, the death of the livestock over the goddess Hathor, who had the head of a cow. This plague begins to attack the very livelihood of the Egyptians. And this great pestilence attacks the Egyptian livestock, but not the Hebrew. Plague number six is the plague of the boils, which is an attack on the goddess Isis or Isis, who was the goddess of medicine and wisdom. This medical goddess could not stop God's plans nor overpower his great power to do this and wreak the body with these boils. Plague number seven is hail. Superior to this god Nut, the goddess of the sky, originally the nighttime sky. Hail rained down from the sky, fire mingled with it and destroyed the land and the animals of the Egyptians, but again, not in the land of Goshen where the Hebrews were. Plague number eight is the plague of locusts. God is greater than Seth, the god of storms and disorder and chaos. This plague of locusts, which utterly devastated their crops, was a great calamitous and chaotic event. And God's greatness was on display, blowing the locusts in and blowing the locusts out at his command. Plague number nine is darkness, which is over Ra, the god Ra, the sun god. Darkness over the land for 3 days, where the power of the sun was not allowed to be seen. Ra was essentially rendered powerless, according to the Egyptian mindset, in the face of Jehovah. Then we have the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, which this is an attack where God's really displaying his superiority over Pharaoh himself. Pharaoh had threatened Moses in chapter 10, verse 28, but God would prove superior to Pharaoh and kill the firstborn of the land. God's revelation of himself to Egypt as well as to the Hebrews was sure. Jehovah is the one who reigns. He is great. He is superior. And he is to be worshipped. So these plagues, they're not just nasty things that took place. There was purpose in what God was doing. He was confronting the Egyptian mindset and the Egyptian God and displaying himself in all of his greatness and power and superiority over all of their so-called gods. It's really an incredible display. Now, with this 10th plague came also another major event in Israelite history, and that is the Passover. With this 10th plague, God told his people that they needed to do certain things, go through a process, right? We talked about this morning, meditation. You're taught something and then you need to go and implement it. Remind yourself what God said. Here's the case. God told them, you need to do this, kill this kind of lamb, he needs to be this old, and he can't have any blemishes, you need to do this to him, and do all these things, and apply the blood to the doorpost, and if you do all that, you'll be safe. Whoever does that would be safe from the death angel passing over them. Okay, we know the story, great event, really depicting here the salvation of Christ. His blood is applied to us, we're safe from death, from spiritual eternal death and all these things. It's a wonderful thing. This Passover would be used as a picture of salvation and Christ's work as well. In fact, Paul calls Christ our Passover to the Corinthian church. But the Passover tested the trust of the Israelites and separated them from the Egyptians for good. Someone is not happy out there, that's for sure. And it's not my child. Right? No, he's still here. Okay, good. Anyone, again, who did not apply the blood, the firstborn of that home would die. And Pharaoh's firstborn died. And because of that, after that, he finally let the people of God go. Okay, which leads then to the next big event, the Exodus. He's got Egyptian bondage, Moses, the plagues, the Passover. And now the Exodus. After that final plague, Pharaoh told the Israelites to leave Egypt, which they did. Chapter 12, verse 36 says that when they left, they plundered Egypt. I almost think the Egyptians were like, here, take it, just leave. Get out. We're tired of you. And they plundered Egypt as they left. They travel and come to the Red Sea, which is the famous occurrence in chapter 14. When Israel faced the difficulty of the Red Sea on one side and the Egyptian armies pursuing them on the other side, the people were in a crisis, but they were not outside of God's care. And at this crisis point, there's this wonderful statement, Exodus 14:13. Moses says, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today." Tremendous statement. That is something we can apply to so many parts of our lives. Don't be afraid. Stand still and watch what God will do. See his salvation. And they do. And we know the story. God parts the Red Sea. People walk through on dry ground. The Egyptian army follows. And they, of course, are killed after them. Now, you have a handout. One of the sides of the double-sided sheet has this map of this proposed path. There's some disagreement about the exact path, but this is a pretty common idea of the path that the people took, this so-called southerly route. And you can see it, how they crossed over part of the Red Sea. Where the arrow is right above, that's still part of the Red Sea. It's the copying just kind of blanked it out. But they're still crossing the Red Sea, and they go south and eventually end up at Mount Sinai. Sometimes we can see a visual thing like this, and it helps us to understand, especially something. I mean, there's no, how many miles equals an inch kind of a thing, but this wasn't just a day jaunt. This was a massive walk with, again, perhaps as many as 2 million people or so. This is a big deal. Took them some time to do this, but God brought them safely to Mount Sinai, which is the next major event. And a lot happens at Mount Sinai. People stay there for quite a while, and a lot happens here. In Exodus 19, after the crossing of the Red Sea, people are safe. Egyptians are destroyed. God's people are finally safe. In Exodus 19, God formally pronounces them as a nation. 19:6, "You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Now, they had already been God's people. That wasn't really in question. But now God formalizes things. Right? Going back even to the Abrahamic promise, covenant, God promised Abram, "I will make of you a great nation." Well, that hadn't happened in Genesis. Formally speaking, the people were certainly numerous, no, without question, but the formalizing of being a nation, that took place after the Exodus, and God pronounced it there. After this, they come, chapter 20 of Exodus, we have God giving them the law, right? Nations need laws, and God gives the law, 10 commandments we have in Exodus 20. God formalizes this again in that passage. Gives instructions for how they were to live, how they were to worship him. If you go on even beyond just the Ten Commandments, God continues to give Moses many instructions of how this nation was to live and how they were, what they were to eat, what they were to not eat, how the clothing they were to wear, and all this kind of stuff, including what would be the central part of their life in the Old Testament, which was the tabernacle. God gives instructions for the tabernacle. And God is very detailed in this. What kind of fabric should be used? What colors should be used? How big it was to be? The furniture that was supposed to be included in the tabernacle. So you have lengthy periods of chapters that are devoted to God giving the instructions. And then following that, lengthy periods of chapter, it's not the right phrase. A lot of chapters following that describe how they did what God told them to do. It's almost a repeat of what God said, but it's like, here's what God said, and here's what we did because of what God said. And a lot of time is given to that, the instructions as well as the implementation. So let's talk about this tabernacle a little bit. Again, this would become really the central feature of the nation of Israel, literally. of the nation of Israel. And their lives were to be centered on what would take place here. Every time they would, that God told them to stop someplace, they would stop and set up the tabernacle. When God wanted them to move on, they'd pack up the tabernacle, special instructions for carrying everything, and they'd move on to the next location until God said to stop. There's six pieces of furniture included. The laver outside, the wash basin, the outside altar, inside. So you have the altar there. You can see the laver, I think, is right there. Inside this is divided into two compartments. You have what was typically called the holy place, the first entrance, and there would be the table of showbread. You'd have the candlestick, and you have the altar of incense. And then inside the next veil is, of course, the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant would rest, presence of God. Into that Holy of Holies, we know this, the Day of Atonement, the one time a year that the high priest was to enter that Holy of Holies, present blood to atone for the people's sins, an incredible thing to behold. So you have another handout here that has also things associated with this, feasts that were instrumental during this time as well. These feasts and festivals that the people participated in. Again, many of these, God instructed them specifically. Some of these would develop later on. But you have the name of the feast. You have the scripture where the information is given, when that was observed, as far as how it corresponds to our calendar today, and then a brief description of what those were. Now, there are three of those feasts that specifically called for the male Israelites to go to Jerusalem. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, that was around Passover. The Feast of Weeks, around Pentecost. And the Feast of Booths. Later on. Okay, these are all important ideas. And this is the calendar. So when Israel would live their life, they would live according to this calendar. Again, much of which was revolved around the tabernacle worship. Sacrifices were involved in different parts of this. And this was the central feature of their life. When God wanted them to move, they all moved. When God wanted them to stop, they all stopped. And they lived their life according to this calendar. And they did it every year. And the cycle continued every year. There were daily sacrifices. There were yearly sacrifices that had to be made. But an incredible thing to consider. Before we conclude with just a few thoughts here. Any thoughts or comments or questions about anything? Yes, Deb.
As I've gone through several times of trying to understand what God gave, the instruction of all these feasts and all the sacrificing for individuals and something, individually, what they're offering. But were they doing that in the wilderness, or was that future looking toward to being in the promised land?
Are you asking, did they offer those sacrifices and do those feasts still in the wilderness?
Yes.
Yes.
And for the individuals, if they were bringing something as a fellowship offering, because I'm just wondering about the amount of livestock and
yep.
all that.
It required a lot, didn't it?
And just even like you were saying, when they moved, they'd pack everything up and leave. And
yep.
It's like that. I mean, that doesn't happen quickly.
Right.
Packing up and then getting to a place and settling and just all that kind of stuff. I've just been curious over the years how much of what's instructed for them to do was that really going on the 40 years they were in the wilderness.
It was. Yep. You see that starting in Leviticus. So Exodus, they get the instructions. You have the construction done for all the tabernacle stuff. The construction of all the materials, the curtains around, the poles, the rings, the furnishings, everything. Leviticus comes around, and they have this great dedication of the tabernacle. And it culminates. I mean, it's set up. They're offering the sacrifices, and things start.
I know that they said the tabernacle up. Yep. I just didn't know how active they were, like the individuals themselves, how active they were. That's a lot of people.
Yep.
And at the very beginning, there was only a few priests.
At the very beginning, there was, but when you've got like 2 million people, there's going to be more. So they developed this. So the part where, yes, it was constructed, it was set up, and things began, there is a development of it as well. Even the organization of it, the logistics of it. Yes, God doesn't give as much information about that aspect, but you're right. It required a lot of manpower and a lot of organization to make all that occur. I mean, it's the same thing as the church, frankly. God gives instructions for the church, right? And we have the beginning of that, Acts 2. The book of Acts is this, it's the church is there, but there's a development of the church that takes place as well. So, yes, it was happening in the wilderness, and it would happen throughout their wilderness wanderings until they reached the promised land. And then, of course, when God, because God's instructions were, you will worship me in the place that I tell you. Well, the place that he told them initially was wherever the tabernacle is. But that ultimate place that God would tell them was where? It was Jerusalem. They weren't in Jerusalem yet. But when God finally said, this is the place, then the temple was built. The permanent place.
But that took a long time.
It took a long time. That's right. Yeah. Good question. Yes?
Jerusalem wasn't Jerusalem until the Jews got there.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. Ian?
Wasn't that same territory called Salem because of Melchizedek, King of Salem?
King of Salem, yeah, there's another name for it, yeah. Yeah. Anything else here? All right, let's do some concluding thoughts. Summary. Some key events. Key event is obviously the Exodus. When you read Old Testament, you find a number of times that God uses this event of the Exodus and brings it back to the people's minds. Remember when I took you out of bondage in Egypt. Remember when this happened. Remember when this happened. This is a key event. And again, the events of the Exodus, Passover, crossing of the Red Sea, this is a big picture of salvation, essentially. Blood of Christ, sacrifice, sacrificial lamb. He's our Passover. He crossed the Red Sea, which is really a picture of the salvation out of the world and into the safety of God. Massive event. So that's a key event. Ten Commandments, obviously a big event. God gives his laws to his people. Construction of the tabernacle, another major event. Setting up the worship system of this nation now. So you have a formalization of the nation after the Exodus. You have the formally giving of laws, and you have the formal construction of worship. Big parts of this nation. Time frame, again, roughly 120 years. Obviously, the first few verses of Exodus 1 are more than that, but the vast majority of time is really spanning these 120 years of Moses' life. Because at the end of Deuteronomy, you have Moses dying. And he's 120 years old. Key books of the Bible written during this time, Genesis through Deuteronomy. The general time frame that most scholars, at least that I'm familiar with, they're all authored by Moses, and the time frame is between 1440 and 1400. Conservative scholars put a date for the Exodus itself at 1446 BC. And then after that, as they're in the wilderness, that's when we believe that Moses penned these first five books.
That was the question I was just going to ask you. With the Bible, these books being written in that wandering time. So,
yeah.
So it served a great purpose.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yes, Ray?
So at this point, it would be written because Egypt had a written language. And so Moses, being educated by them, could write it. Whereas a lot of the previous stuff was oral.
Previous stuff.
Previous biblical from Genesis.
Stories would have passed down orally, largely, yes.
But by this time, it's literally written.
It's written in Hebrew.
And so,
yeah, it's written in Hebrew.
Moses that developed the Hebrew writing.
Oh, that's a good question. I bet you Ian has an answer for that. Go ahead.
There are scholars that link the Semitic languages. They call it Proto-Semitic, which became Proto-Hebrew. And the evidence of that language being constructed, or there's some that would say it was given to Moses to understand. But it was a unique language. In fact, it was probably the first one that actually had an alphabet. Most of the other languages at that time were hieroglyphs or pictographs. So, when you look at whether it's Chinese or Egyptian or anything else, and you have thousands and thousands of things that construe a word or a concept, Proto-Hebrew or the Proto-Semitic languages, which came about coincidentally, I'm doing that because that's what the world would say, around the time of the Exodus, and that allowed for the alphabet, right, the Aleph Beth, that we have for language that you can construct thousands of letters today, or words today from those minimal letters. So the actual, the ability for Moses and the Levites and the scribes at that time to actually convey, because think about this, they were commanded to understand, and put on their foreheads the work. So how could you do that when you would need thousands and thousands of pictograms? So they were able to, in very simple but mathematically impressive language, Proto-Hebrew, to create all, the Torah, the Pentateuch. So, you could say it was a unique language, but what's even more interesting is the term Hebrew, right? So when you think about, and this is going back to our study of Genesis, at the Tower of Babel, one of the people that left with his people group was Eber, or Heber, and Heber was the father of the Hebrew people, and perhaps the Hebrew language. So was that the time when that language was created miraculously by the Lord, when that people group was scattered?
Yeah, the people had survived before being in Egypt. Yeah. They could talk, there's language, and that carried through the Hebrew people. Now, the interesting question is, with Moses, he was Hebrew, but raised an Egyptian. So he would have learned the Egyptian language, the Egyptian writing. You're right about that, Ray. But when it came time to write the scripture, he did not write it in the hieroglyphs that would have been in Egypt. He wrote it according to the Hebrew language. Yeah, Gary?
Anything in Midian that he could have learned or contributed to the language?
Perhaps, yeah. But it is rooted in that people group.
What's interesting with Midian is there's a link with that people, right? And where did he first see Yahweh? In Midian.
Mm-hmm.
So is the the revelation or adaptation or growth of the Proto-Semitic languages into Hebrew, the Hebrew we know today, did it happen there? So it's called the thing, so.
Yeah. Good question. Yes, Steph?
Yeah. Another interesting thing that we've been learning about the Hebrew language is that as they're uncovering in the city of David the artifacts and the things that have the language written down on their pieces of jars or pottery or whatever, inscriptions, insignias, rings,
yep.
It's the same language. And even if you look at the development of the English language from Britain to us, it's so different that mm-hmm. when you go to, say, the archives in D.C., there are some things you can't even read because it is so vastly different. Yet the Hebrew language is 100% similar. Like, they can read it directly from digging up in the UK.
Yeah, good.
That's why I mentioned the mathematical significance, because it's a rabbit trail, but you can... If you research how the Hebrew language is constructed, the actual strokes behind the formation of each letter have a direct correlation to the Fibonacci series or the golden ratio.
I knew that.
We knew that, Brad. I appreciate you just letting him answer that for you.
I didn't want to show off.
Key figure, of course, Moses is the key figure in this time frame. God called him, God raised him up, God led him to lead the people of Israel out. But here's really the key truth. Take something away from this today. God is superior over all. And he demonstrated that in Egypt, being superior over all of those Egyptian so-called gods. He demonstrated that with his own people in bringing them safely out, in leading them, providing manna for them. We didn't even talk about that. Providing food for them, providing water for them. God is superior over all. Okay? Good thoughts. Any last final comments or anything? Very good. Well, you are dismissed.